reactivates the pain months or years later. When Ramachandran reviewed the histories of people with painful frozen arms, he discovered that they had all had their arms in slings or casts for several months before amputation. Their brain maps now seemed to record for all time the fixed position of the arm just prior to amputation. He began to suspect that it was the very fact that the limb did not exist that allowed the sensation of paralysis to persist. Normally, when the motor command center in the brain sends out an order to move the arm, the brain gets feedback from various senses, confirming that the order has been executed. But the brain of a person without a limb never gets confirmation that the arm has moved, since there are neither arm nor motion sensors in the arm to provide that feedback. Thus, the brain is left with the impression that the arm is frozen. Because the arm had been stuck in a cast or sling for months, the brain map developed a representation of the arm as unmoving. When the arm was removed, there was no new input to alter the brain map, so the mental representation of the limb as fixed became frozen in time, a situation similar to the learned paralysis that Taub discovered in stroke patients. Ramachandran came to believe that the absence of feedback causes not only frozen phantoms, but phantom pain. The brain's motor center might send commands for the hand muscles to contract, but getting no feedback confirming the hand has moved, escalates its command as if to say, "Clench! You're not clenching enough! You haven't touched the palm yet! Clench as hard as you can!" These patients feel their fingernails are digging into their palms. While actual clenching caused pain when the arm was present, this imaginary clenching evokes pain because maximum contraction and pain are associated in memory. Ramachandran next asked a most daring question, whether phantom paralysis and pain could be unlearned. This was the sort of question psychiatrists, psychologists, and psychoanalysts might ask. How does one change a situation that has a psychic but not a material reality? Ramachandran's work began to blur the boundary between neurology and psychiatry, reality and illusion. Ramachandran then hit on the wizard-like idea of fighting one illusion with another. What if he could send false signals to the brain to make the patient think that the non-existent limb was moving? That question led him to invent a mirror box designed to fool the patient's brain. It would show him the mirror image of his good hand in order to make him believe it was his amputated hand, resurrected. The mirror box is the size of a large cake box, without a top, and is divided into two compartments, one on the left and one on the right. There are two holes in the front of the box. If the patient's left was amputated, he puts his good right hand through the hole and into the right compartment. Then he is told to imagine putting his phantom hand into the left compartment. The divider that separates the two compartments is a vertical mirror facing the good hand. Because there is no top on the box, the patient can, by leaning a bit to the right, see a mirror image reflection of his good right hand, which will seem to be his left hand as it was before the amputation. As he moves his right hand back and forth, his resurrected left hand will also appear to move back and forth, superimposed on his phantom. Ramachandran hoped the patient's brain might get the impression that the phantom arm was moving. To find subjects to test his mirror box, Ramachandran ran enigmatic ads in local newspapers saying, "Amputees needed." Philip Martinez responded. About a decade before, Philip was hurled from his motorcycle while going 45 miles per hour. All the nerves leading from his left hand and arm to his spine were torn out by the accident. His arm was still attached to his body, but no functioning nerve sent signals from his spine to his arm, and no nerves entered his spine to convey sensation to his brain. Philip's arm was worse than useless, an immovable burden he had to keep in a sling, and he eventually chose to have the arm amputated. But he was left with terrible phantom pain in his phantom elbow. The phantom arm also felt paralyzed, and he had the sense that if he could only somehow move it, he might relieve the pain. This dilemma so depressed him that he contemplated suicide. When Philip put his good arm into the mirror box, he not only began to see his phantom move, but he felt it moving for the first time. Amazed and overwhelmed with joy, Philip said he felt his phantom arm was plugged in again. Yet the moment he stopped looking at the mirror image or closed his eyes, the phantom froze. Ramachandran gave Philip the mirror box to take home to practice with, hoping that Philip might unlearn his paralysis by stimulating a plastic change that would rewire his brain map. Philip used the box for 10 minutes a day, but it still seemed only to work when his eyes were open, looking at the mirror image of his good hand. Then, after 4 weeks, Ramachandran got an excited call from Philip. Not only was his phantom arm permanently unfrozen, it was gone, even when he wasn't using the box. Gone, too, was his phantom elbow and its excruciating pain. Only painless phantom fingers were left, dangling from his shoulder. V.S. Ramachandran, the neurological illusionist, had become the first physician to perform a seemingly impossible operation, the successful amputation of a phantom limb. Ramachandran has used his box with a number of patients, about half of whom have lost their phantom pain, unfrozen their phantoms, and started to feel control over them. Other scientists have also found that patients who train with the mirror box get better. fMRI brain scans show that as these patients improve, the motor maps for their phantoms increase, the map shrinkage that accompanies amputation is reversed, and sensory and motor maps normalize. The mirror box appears to cure pain by altering the patient's perception of their body image. This is a remarkable discovery because it sheds light both on how our minds work and on how we experience pain. Pain and body image are closely related. We always experience pain as projected into the body. When you throw your back out, you say, "My back is killing me," and not, "My pain system is killing me." But as phantoms show, we don't need a body part or even pain receptors to feel pain. We need only a body image produced by our brain maps. People with actual limbs don't usually realize this, because the body images of our limbs are perfectly projected onto our actual limbs, making it impossible to distinguish our body image from our body. Your own body is a phantom, says Ramachandran, one that your brain has constructed purely for convenience. Distorted body images are common and demonstrate that there is a difference between the body image and the body itself. Anorexics experience their bodies as fat when they are on the edge of starvation. People with distorted body images, a condition called body dysmorphic disorder, can experience a part of the body that is perfectly within the norm as defective. They think their ears, nose, lips, breasts, penis, vagina, or thighs are too large or too small, or just wrong, and they feel tremendous shame. Marilyn Monroe experienced herself as having many bodily defects. Such people often seek plastic surgery but still feel misshapen after their operations. What they need instead is neuroplastic surgery to change their body image. Ramachandran's success with rewiring phantoms suggested to him that there may be ways to rewire distorted body images. To better understand what he meant by a body image, I asked him if he might demonstrate the difference between it, a mental construct, and the material body. Taking out the type of fake rubber hand sold in novelty shops, he sat me at a table and placed the fake hand on it, its fingers parallel to the table edge in front of me, about an inch from the edge. He told me to put my hand on the table, parallel to the fake hand, but about 8 inches from the table's edge. My hand and the fake were perfectly aligned, pointing in the same direction. Then he put a cardboard screen between the fake hand and my own, so I could see only the fake. Then with his hand, he stroked the fake hand as I watched. With his other hand, he simultaneously stroked my hand, hidden behind the screen. When he stroked the fake's thumb, he stroked my thumb. When he tapped the fake pinky 3 times, he tapped my pinky 3 times in the same rhythm. When he stroked the fake middle finger, he stroked my middle finger. Within moments, my feeling that my own hand was being stroked disappeared, and I began to experience the feeling I was being stroked as if coming from the fake hand. The dummy hand had become part of my body image. This illusion works by the same principle that fools us into thinking that ventriloquists' dummies, or cartoons, or movie actors in films, are actually talking. because the lips move in sync with the sound. Then Ramachandran performed an even simpler trick. He told me to put my right hand under the table, so my hand was hidden. Then he tapped the tabletop with one hand, while with his other he tapped mine under the table, where I couldn't see it, in an identical rhythm. When he moved the spot where he hit the tabletop, a bit to the left or right, he moved his hand under the table exactly the same way. After a few minutes, I stopped experiencing him as tapping my hand under the table and instead, fantastic as it sounds, started to feel that the body image of my hand had merged with the tabletop, so that the sensation of being tapped seemed to come from the tabletop. He had created an illusion in which my sensory body image had now been expanded to include a piece of furniture. Ramachandran has wired subjects to a galvanic skin response meter that measures stress responses during this table experiment. After stroking the tabletop and a patient's hand under the table until his body image included the table, he would pull out a hammer and bash the tabletop. The subject's stress response went through the roof, just as if Ramachandran had smashed the subject's actual hand. According to Ramachandran, pain, like the body image, is created by the brain and projected onto the body. This assertion is contrary to common sense and the traditional neurological view of pain that says that when we are hurt, our pain receptors send a one-way signal to the brain's pain center, and that the intensity of pain perceived is proportional to the seriousness of the injury. We assume that pain always files an accurate damage report. This traditional view dates back to the philosopher Descartes, who saw the brain as a passive recipient of pain. But that view was overturned in 1965 when neuroscientists Ronald Melzack, a Canadian who studied phantom limbs and pain, and Patrick Wall, an Englishman who studied pain and plasticity, wrote the most important article in the history of pain. Wall and Melzack's theory asserted that the pain system is spread throughout the brain and spinal cord, and far from being a passive recipient of pain, the brain always controls the pain signals we feel. Their gate control theory of pain proposed a series of controls or gates between the site of injury and the brain. When pain messages are sent from damaged tissue through the nervous system, they pass through several gates, starting in the spinal cord, before they get to the brain. But these messages travel only if the brain gives them permission, after determining they are important enough to be let through. If permission is granted, a gate will open and increase the feeling of pain by allowing certain neurons to turn on and transmit their signals. The brain can also close a gate and block the pain signal by releasing endorphins, the narcotics made by the body to quell pain. The gate theory made sense of all sorts of pain experiences. For instance, when the U.S. troops landed in Italy in World War II, 70% of the men who were seriously wounded reported that they were not in pain and did not want painkillers. Men wounded on the battlefield often don't feel pain and keep fighting. It's as if the brain closes the gate to keep the embattled soldier's attention riveted on how to get out of harm's way. Only when he is safe are the pain signals allowed to pass to the brain. Physicians have long known that a patient who expects to get pain relief from a pill often does, even though it is a placebo containing no medication. fMRI brain scans show that during the placebo effect, the brain turns down its own pain-responsive regions. When a mother soothes her hurt child by stroking and talking sweetly to her, she is helping the child's brain turn down the volume on its pain. How much pain we feel is determined in significant part by our brains and minds, our current mood, our past experiences of pain, our psychology, and how serious we think our injury is. Wall and Melzack showed that the neurons in our pain system are far more plastic than we ever imagined, that important pain maps in the spinal cord can change following injury, and that a chronic injury can make the cells in the pain system fire more easily, a plastic alteration, making a person hypersensitive to pain. Maps can also enlarge their receptive field, coming to represent more of the body's surface, increasing pain sensitivity. As the maps change, Pain signals in one map can spill into adjacent pain maps, and we may develop referred pain, when we are hurt in one body part but feel the pain in another. Sometimes a single pain signal reverberates throughout the brain so that pain persists even after its original stimulus has stopped. The gait theory led to new treatments for blocking pain. Wall co-invented transcutaneous electrical nerve stimulation, or TENS, TENS, which uses electric current to stimulate neurons that inhibit pain, helping in effect to close the gait. The gait theory also made Western scientists less skeptical of acupuncture, which reduces pain by stimulating points of the body often far from the site where the pain is felt. It seemed possible that acupuncture turns on neurons that inhibit pain, closing gates and blocking pain perception. Melzack and Wall had another revolutionary insight, that the pain system includes motor components. When we cut a finger, we reflexively squeeze it, a motor act. We instinctively guard an injured ankle by finding a safe position. Guarding commands, don't move a muscle until that ankle's better. Extending the gait theory, Ramachandran developed his next idea, that pain is a complex system under the plastic brain's control. He summed this up as follows. Pain is an opinion on the organism's state of health, rather than a mere reflexive response to injury. The brain gathers evidence from many sources before triggering pain. He has also said that pain is an illusion and that our mind is a virtual reality machine, which experiences the world indirectly and processes it at one remove, constructing a model in our head. So pain, like the body image, is a construct of our brain. Since Ramachandran could use his mirror box to modify a body image and eliminate a phantom and its pain, could he also use the mirror box to make chronic pain in a real limb disappear? Ramachandran thought he might be able to remedy type 1 chronic pain, experienced in a disorder called reflex sympathetic dystrophy. This occurs when a minor injury, a bruise, or an insect bite on the fingertip makes an entire limb so excruciatingly painful that guarding prevents the patient from moving it. The condition can last long after the original injury and often becomes chronic, accompanied by burning discomfort and agonizing pain in response to a light brushing or stroking of the skin. Ramachandran theorized that the brain's plastic ability to rewire itself was leading to a pathological form of guarding. When we guard, we prevent our muscles from moving and aggravating our injury. If we had to remind ourselves consciously not to move, we'd become exhausted and slip up, hurt ourselves, and feel pain. Now suppose, thought Ramachandran, the brain preempts the mistaken movement by triggering pain the moment before the movement takes place. Between the time when the motor center issues the command to move and the time when the move is performed. What better way for the brain to prevent movement than to make sure the motor command itself triggers pain? Ramachandran came to believe that in these chronic pain patients, the motor command got wired into the pain system, so that even though the limb had healed, when the brain sent out a motor command to move the arm, it still triggered pain. Ramachandran called this learned pain, and wondered whether the mirror box could help relieve it. All the traditional remedies had been tried on these patients, interrupting the nerve connection to the painful area, physiotherapy, painkillers, acupuncture, and osteopathy, to no avail. In a study conducted by a team that included Patrick Wall, the patient was instructed to put both hands into the mirror box, sitting so he could see only his good arm and its reflection in the mirror. The patient then moved his good arm in whatever way he chose, and his affected one, if possible, in the box for 10 minutes several times a day for several weeks. Perhaps the moving reflection, which occurred without a motor command initiating it, was fooling the patient's brain into thinking his hurt arm could now move freely without pain. Or perhaps this exercise was enabling the brain to learn that guarding was no longer necessary, so it would disconnect the neuronal link between the motor command to move the arm and the pain system. Patients who had had the pain syndrome for only 2 months got better. The first day, the pain lessened, and relief lasted even after a mirror session was over. After a month, they no longer had any pain. Patients who had had the syndrome for between 5 months and a year didn't do quite as well, but they lost stiffness in their limbs and were able to go back to work. Those who had had the pain for longer than 2 years failed to get better. Why? One thought was that these long-term patients had not moved their guarded limbs for so long that the motor maps for the affected limb had begun to waste away. Once again, use it or lose it. All that remained were the few links that were most active when the limb was last used, and unfortunately, these were links to the pain system. Just as patients who wore casts before amputations developed phantoms stuck where their arms were just before the amputation. An Australian scientist, G. L. Mosley, thought he might be able to help the patients who hadn't improved by using the mirror box, often because their pain was so great they couldn't move their limbs in mirror therapy. Mosley thought that building up the affected limb's motor map with mental exercises might trigger plastic change. He asked these patients to simply imagine moving their painful limbs without executing the movements in order to activate brain networks for movement. The patients also looked at pictures of hands to determine whether they were the left or right until they could identify them quickly and accurately, a task known to activate the motor cortex. They were shown hands in various positions and asked to imagine them for 15 minutes 3 times a day. After practicing the visualization exercises, they did the mirror therapy. And with 12 weeks of therapy, pain had diminished in some and had disappeared in half. Think how remarkable this is. For a most excruciating chronic pain, a whole new treatment that uses imagination and illusion to restructure brain maps plastically without medication, needles, or electricity. The discovery of pain maps has also led to new approaches to surgery and the use of pain medication. Postoperative phantom pain can be minimized if surgical patients get local nerve blocks or local anesthetics that act on peripheral nerves before the general anesthetic puts them to sleep. Painkillers, administered before surgery, not just afterward, appear to prevent plastic changes in the brain's pain map that may lock in pain. Ramachandran and Eric Altshuler have shown that the mirror box is effective on other non-phantom problems, such as the paralyzed legs of stroke patients. Mirror therapy differs from TOBS in that it fools the patient's brain into thinking he is moving the affected limb, and so it begins to stimulate that limb's motor programs. Another study showed that mirror therapy was helpful in preparing a severely paralyzed stroke patient who had no use of one side of the body for a TOB-like treatment. The patient recovered some use of his arm, the first occasion in which two novel plasticity-based approaches, mirror therapy and CI-like therapy, were used in sequence. In India, Ramachandran grew up in a world where many things that seem fantastic to Westerners were commonplace. He knew about yogis who relieved suffering with meditation and walked barefoot across hot coals or lay down on nails. He saw religious people in trances putting needles through their chins. The idea that living things change their forms was widely accepted. The power of the mind to influence the body was taken for granted, and illusion was seen as so fundamental a force that it was represented in the deity Maya, the goddess of illusion. He has transposed a sense of wonder from the streets of India to Western neurology, and his work inspires questions that mingle the two. What is a trance but a closing down of the gates of pain within us? Why should we think phantom pain any less real than ordinary pain? And he has reminded us that great science can still be done with elegant simplicity. Chapter 8. Imagination: How Thinking Makes It So. I am in Boston in the laboratory for magnetic brain stimulation at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, part of Harvard Medical School. Alvaro Pascual Leon is chief of the center, and his experiments have shown that we can change our brain anatomy simply by using our imaginations. He has just put a paddle-shaped machine on the left side of my head. The device emits transcranial magnetic stimulation, or TMS, and can influence my behavior. Inside the machine's plastic casing is a coil of copper wire. through which a current passes to generate a changing magnetic field that surges into my brain, into the cable-like axons of my neurons, and from there, into the motor map of my hand in the outer layer of my cerebral cortex. A changing magnetic field induces an electric current around it, and Pascual Léon has pioneered the use of TMS to make neurons fire. Each time he turns on the magnetic field, the fourth finger on my right hand moves, because he is stimulating an area of about 0.5 cubic centimeter in my brain, consisting of millions of cells, the brain map for that finger. TMS is an ingenious bridge into my brain. Its magnetic field passes painlessly and harmlessly through my body, inducing an electric current only when the field reaches my neurons. Wilder Penfield had to open the skull surgically and insert his electric probe into the brain to stimulate the motor or sensory cortex. When Pascual Léon turns on the machine and makes my finger move, I experience exactly what Penfield's patients did when he cut open their skulls and prodded them with large electrodes. Alvaro Pascual Léon is young for all he has accomplished. He was born in 1961 in Valencia, Spain, and has conducted research both there and in the United States. Pascual Léon's parents, both physicians, sent him to a German school in Spain where, like many neuroplasticians, he studied the classical Greek and German philosophers before turning to medicine. He took his combined MD and PhD in physiology in Freiburg, then went to the United States for further training. Pascual Léon has olive skin, dark hair, and an expressive voice, and he radiates a serious playfulness. His small office is dominated by the massive Apple computer screen he uses to display what he sees through his TMS window onto the brain. Emails from collaborators pour in from far-flung parts of the world. There are books on electromagnetism shelved behind him and papers everywhere. He was the first to use TMS to map the brain. TMS can be used either to turn on a brain area or to block it from functioning, depending on the intensity and frequency used. To determine the function of a specific brain area, he fires bursts of TMS to temporarily block the area from working, then observes which mental function is lost. He is also one of the great pioneers in the use of high-frequency repetitive TMS, or RTMS. High-frequency repetitive TMS can activate neurons so much that they excite each other and keep firing even after the original burst of RTMS has stopped. This turns a brain area on for a while and can be used therapeutically. For instance, in some depressions, the prefrontal cortex is partially turned off and underfunctioning. Pascual Léon's group was the first to show that RTMS is effective in treating such severely depressed patients. 70% of those who had failed all the traditional treatments improved with RTMS and had fewer side effects than with medication. In the early 1990s, when Pascual Léon was still a young medical fellow at the National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke, he did experiments, celebrated among neuroplasticians for their elegance, that perfected a way to map the brain, made his imagination experiments possible, and taught us how we learn skills. He studied how people learn new skills by using TMS to map the brains of blind subjects learning to read Braille. The subject studied Braille for a year, 5 days a week, for 2 hours a day in class, followed by an hour of homework. Braille readers scan by moving their index fingers across a series of small raised dots, a motor activity. Then they feel the arrangement of the dots, a sensory activity. These findings were among the first to confirm that when human beings learn a new skill, plastic change occurs. When Pascual Léon used TMS to map the motor cortex, he found that the maps for people's Braille reading fingers were larger than the maps for their other index fingers, and also those for the index fingers of non-Braille readers. Pascual Léon also found that the motor maps increased in size as the subjects increased the number of words per minute they could read. But his most surprising discovery, one with major implications for learning any skill, was the way the plastic change occurred over the course of each week. The subjects were mapped with TMS on Fridays, at the end of the week's training, and on Mondays, after they had rested for the weekend. Pascual Léon found that the changes were different on Friday and Monday. From the beginning of the study, Friday maps showed very rapid and dramatic expansion, but by Monday, these maps had returned to their baseline size. The Friday maps continued to grow for 6 months, stubbornly returning to baseline each Monday. After about 6 months, the Friday maps were still increasing, but not as much as in the first 6 months. Monday maps showed an opposite pattern. They didn't begin to change until 6 months into the training. Then they increased slowly and plateaued at 10 months. The speed at which the subjects could read Braille correlated much better with the Monday maps, and though the changes on Mondays were never as dramatic as on Fridays, they were more stable. At the end of 10 months, the Braille students took 2 months off. When they returned, they were remapped, and their maps were unchanged from the last Monday mapping 2 months before. Thus, daily training led to dramatic short-term changes during the week. But over the weekends and months, more permanent changes were seen on Mondays. Pasquale Leon believes that the differing results on Monday and Friday suggest differing plastic mechanisms. The fast Friday changes strengthen existing neuronal connections and unmask buried pathways. The slower, more permanent Monday changes suggest the formation of brand new structures, probably the sprouting of new neuronal connections and synapses. Understanding this tortoise and hare effect can help us understand what we must do to truly master new skills. After a brief period of practice, as when we cram for a test, it is relatively easy to improve because we are likely strengthening existing synaptic connections. But we quickly forget what we've crammed because these are easy-come, easy-go neuronal connections and are rapidly reversed. Maintaining improvement and making a skill permanent require the slow, steady work that probably forms new connections. If a learner thinks he is making no cumulative progress or feels his mind is like a sieve, he needs to keep at the skill until he gets the Monday effect, which in Braille readers took 6 months. The Friday-Monday difference is probably why some people, the tortoises, who seem slow to pick up a skill, may nevertheless learn it better than their hare friends. The quick studies, who won't necessarily hold on to what they have learned without the sustained practice that solidifies the learning. Pasquale Leon expanded his study to examine how Braille readers get so much information through their fingertips. It is well known that the blind can develop superior non-visual senses and that Braille readers gain extraordinary sensitivity in their Braille reading fingers. Pasquale Leon wanted to see if that increased skill was facilitated by an enlargement of the sensory map for touch, or by plastic change in other parts of the brain, such as the visual cortex, which might be underused since it wasn't getting input from the eyes. He reasoned that if the visual cortex helped the subjects to read Braille, blocking it would interfere with Braille reading. And it did. When the team applied blocking TMS to the visual cortex of Braille readers to create a virtual lesion, the subjects could not read Braille or feel with the Braille reading finger. The visual cortex had been recruited to process information derived from touch. Blocking TMS applied to the visual cortex of sighted people had no effect on their ability to feel, indicating that something unique was happening to the blind Braille readers. A part of the brain devoted to one sense had become devoted to another, the kind of plastic reorganization suggested by Baccarita. Pasquale Leon also showed that the better a person could read Braille, the more the visual cortex was involved. His next venture would break ground in a new way altogether by showing that our thoughts can change the material structure of our brains. He would study the way thoughts change the brain by using TMS to observe changes in the finger maps of people learning to play the piano. One of Pasquale Leon's heroes, the great Spanish neuroanatomist and Nobel laureate, Santiago Ramón y Cajal, who spent his later life looking in vain for brain plasticity, proposed in 1894 that the organ of thought is, within certain limits, malleable and perfectible by well-directed mental exercise. In 1904, he argued that thoughts, repeated in mental practice, must strengthen the existing neuronal connections and create new ones. He also had the intuition that this process would be particularly pronounced in neurons that control the fingers in pianists, who do so much mental practice. Ramón y Cajal, using his imagination, had painted a picture of a plastic brain but lacked the tools to prove it. Pascual Leon now thought he had a tool in TMS to test whether mental practice and imagination in fact led to physical changes. The details of the imagining experiment were simple and picked up Cajal's idea to use the piano. Pascual Leon taught two groups of people, who had never studied piano, a sequence of notes, showing them which fingers to move and letting them hear the notes as they were played. Then members of one group, the mental practice group, sat in front of an electric piano keyboard 2 hours a day for 5 days and imagined both playing the sequence and hearing it played. A second physical practice group actually played the piano 2 hours a day for 5 days. Both groups had their brains mapped before the experiment, each day during it, and afterward. Then both groups were asked to play the sequence, and a computer measured the accuracy of their performances. Pascual Leon found that both groups learned to play the sequence, and both showed similar brain map changes. Remarkably, mental practice alone produced the same physical changes in the motor system as actually playing the piece. By the end of the fifth day, the changes in motor signals to the muscles were the same in both groups, and the imagining players were as accurate as the actual players were on their third day. The level of improvement at 5 days in the mental practice group, however substantial, was not as great as those who did physical practice. But when the mental practice group finished its mental training and was given a single 2-hour physical practice session, its overall performance improved to the level of the physical practice group's performance at 5 days. Clearly, mental practice is an effective way to prepare for learning a physical skill with minimal physical practice. We all do what scientists call mental practice or mental rehearsing when we memorize answers for a test, learn lines for a play, or rehearse any kind of performance or presentation. But because few of us do it systematically, we underestimate its effectiveness.
This is the end of disc number 6. Please insert disc number 7.